meditation very helpful for our lives, for all of our lives actually. And it fits into the whole of the Buddha's teaching. The Buddha's teachings are, I say, like a complete teaching, because they encompass the whole of our lives. It's not only, meditation is a very popular activity, Buddhist meditation, other types of meditation, very, very popular these days because it's got immediate benefits. You know, you can see people find, don't they, that they become much more peaceful, they can develop peace in their lives. They also develop a certain amount of, you know, even-mindedness, so that when they experience difficult situations, they don't necessarily overreact. They can stand back a bit. So meditation is very popular, whether it's Buddhist or yoga. There's many types of meditation available these days. But it fits into the whole context of the Buddha's teaching, because the Buddha was talking about the way we live, the way we act, the way we speak, very important. And he said that that is the basis, actually, for our meditation, developing meditation. Because the way we speak and the way we act, when we sit down to meditate, they come back to us, don't they? Especially if we've said or done something we don't like. Then, you know, we can spend the whole meditation thinking about, oh, I shouldn't have said that, or I should have said this. So that's a very important support for the meditation. And of course, the main purpose of the meditation is to develop clarity, to develop clarity and knowing. The meditator's job, actually, the only job for a meditator, is to know what's going on now. And why do we need to know what's going on now? Because if we don't know what's going on now, how are we going to develop understanding? You know, how are we going to develop wisdom? How are we going to see into the nature of this body and this mind, life? So this is the reason, you know, meditation is very important, central to the Buddha's teaching, actually, because then we have this clarity, we have this being present to what we're experiencing. And when we are present, then we can develop understanding about that, and then we can develop the wisdom that can lead to permanent changes in our lives, increase the happiness, increase the efficiency, the way we interact with people. So meditation is part of the whole of the Buddha's teachings. I like to emphasize that, actually. So it's very important to see it in a context. But having said that, you know, many people said to Ajahn Chah, for instance, when he taught meditation, Ajahn Chah was a famous Thai meditation teacher who went to he taught in the West a little before he passed away. And, you know, people said to him, well, you know, traditionally in Buddhist countries, you should start from what your speech and your actions, then you develop the meditation, and then you develop wisdom. And he said, but in the West, people, they start from meditation. He said, no matter. It's all interconnected. It's all part and parcel. So, in other words, when you meditate, you see the mind. Then, when you see your mind, you see what's going on in your life. Then you see your actions and your speech much clearer. And then you make changes to that. You can adjust it to bring around more peaceful and happier results. So really, wherever you start with the Buddha's teaching, it all feeds in together. It's all integrated. So it's very, it's not surprising in a way, because our minds are just one phenomenon, really. Even though, to a large extent, we live very compartmentalized lives. You know, we have, you know, work, and we have, you know, the activities that we do, you know, sports we might do, social events, and all these sorts of things. But really, it's all one mind, actually. And sometimes we think we're different people in different settings, but really it all feeds in together. But this evening I wanted to introduce meditation, a form of meditation that I think very useful, not only while you're meditating, but also in daily life, you know, because it's very important. Because, as I say, meditation is, you know, usually for some people will be half an hour, maybe an hour a day, and then you've got the rest of the time, you know, 23 hours. So it's very important that you use those 23 hours well, so that when you sit down to meditate, it's much easier and you can go deeper. So this evening I was going to just talk about three aspects of meditation that are very important for our lives too, actually, because I like to emphasize that meditation is actually a training for the mind. The Buddhist teaching is all about training. It's not about telling you you should do this, you should do that, but it's advising you to train and see the results of that training. So even, you know, like the precepts that we talk about, the training in body and speech, they're called training rules. So they're not commandments by any means. You know, the Buddha's not saying you have to do this. And immediately, you know, you have the idea of training. It means you won't be perfect to begin with. You know, it's a gradual process. But the whole of the path is about training, about learning, and not necessarily believing what you're told, but to investigate that. Because for us to really make something our own wisdom, our own truth, we have to investigate it. We have to look into it and find out if it's true for our experience. So this is very much the whole import of the path of the Buddha, actually. An experiential training of body, speech and mind. So the whole person. And as I was saying, very important with the beginning of the meditation to be clear why we're meditating. You know, often, myself included, can sit down and you can be very fuzzy about why you're meditating. It's very good to have a clear intention, because if we don't, then, you know, the intention that will take over is what sort of we're not really conscious of, but it's just behind, you know, just in, just there, you know, this agenda may be, you know, want to get away from work, want to, you know, tired, want to rest, this sort of thing. And this doesn't lead to a lot of clarity in the meditation. So we should start the meditation being very clear. And some of the good things to, you know, to have as an intention are just to be mindful, to be present, to be awake. You know, especially when we're tired, if we can sort of, as Ajahn Brahm says, program our minds so that, you know, we say, well, I know I'm tired, but I'm going to be awake for this meditation. I'm going to be, you know, alert. So this is very, very important for giving the mind a direction, giving the mind something to aim at. And I'd like to say, it's not like expectation. Expectation is sort of undermines the meditation, because we're expecting a certain result. You know, we have it in mind that, you know, I'm going to get peaceful, or I'm going to get first jhana, or any of these deep states of meditation. And of course you set yourself up, don't you? I mean, immediately you have these expectations, grand expectations, you set yourself up. Whereas an intention is really an aim, what we're aiming at. And so this is more like, whether it happens, we don't know, but this is what we're aiming at. You can't be sure. Whereas an expectation, it's got to happen. If it doesn't happen, it's not a good meditation, or it's, you know, it's not successful. So intention is very important for the meditation, for our lives, actually. Because often, you know, in relationships, in a lot of our doings, we're not clear about our intention, you know, not clear where we're coming from to our motivation. So to train ourselves to be aware of our intention is quite a good thing, not only in meditation, in daily life too, because that can, it leads to great success, actually, because we'll achieve what we're aiming at if we have it in mind. And a good example for me, if you don't have an intention, for instance, somebody asked me, will Christians become enlightened? I said, well, they don't intend to become enlightened, so why would they? I mean, if you don't have that intention, if you don't have that agenda, how's it going to happen? So it's important to have, you know, an aim, have an intention in mind. That's very, very helpful. And the second part of the meditation that I emphasize is called priming the mind. Now, priming the mind is bringing like a positive frame of mind up, encouraging a positive frame of mind. And this is very good for the meditation, because when we start the meditation, we may have, you know, as we all do from the day, residue of irritations, annoyances, you know, these negative aspects in mind. And they're there. And So if we can bring up a positive state of mind, that will often allow us to let go of the negative. It's not to cover up the negative. You know, sometimes I think people think of this as like cosmetic, we're just covering it over it. No, that's not the idea. But as soon as you develop a positive state of mind, the negative will go. Like if you light a candle, the darkness will go. So in very much the same way, you know, tonight, for instance, there are many, many different ways in Buddhism that you can develop positive states of mind. And one of the ways that I will be using is gratitude. Gratitude is a good subject for bringing up positive states of mind. So once one's developed a positive state of mind using gratitude, you can use metta. If we chanted that this evening, you can use that. You can use reflections on the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha. You can have reflections on your generosity, things you've done for others, for yourself even, and also the fact that you know your conduct has been good. You haven't harmed people. You've helped people. That sort of thing. So there's many, many different ways we can bring up positive states of mind. But that is important, and then that feeling will come. You know, there's a feeling that comes from it. And then we can bring up, and this evening we can use the breath. It's very common in Buddhist meditation to use the breath. It's a very good meditation object because we have it all the time. And unless we've died, it's still there. So it's very portable. So this is a very good meditation subject to use. And what I encourage is to combine the feeling that you've roused with the breath. And very important is to use the breath not as a, not to exclude things. You're using the breath as a, like a touchstone, I call it a reference point, to be in the present moment. Because when we breathe, it's only the present breath that we can be aware of. Past breath gone. Future breaths may haven't come yet. So it's a very good object for being in the present. So we can use that to ground us in the present. But it's not there to get rid of thoughts. It's not there to get rid of feelings in the body. It's not there to get rid of anything. It's there to bring us into the present. And when we're in the present, we can see these things a lot clearer. Usually, we get caught up in thinking or whatever, but eventually, yes, the breath, come back to the breath. So we can come back to the breath. And that gives us contact with the present moment. This is a very useful thing in daily life. I'm not suggesting that you use the awareness of the breath throughout every moment of the day, but every time, every so often, come back to it. And just give the mind, it's like giving the mind a home actually, give it a rest, a reference point. And then when you're in the present, it can make whatever you're experiencing much clearer actually, much, much clearer. Very useful if you're in if you're upset or there's a very difficult situation going on, you can just get a little break, even for a few moments, just by being with the breath. You don't have to, go somewhere special. You know, Ajahn Chah once said, you know, he's asked, Ajahn Chah, this famous Thai meditation master, somebody once said, we don't have enough time to meditate. One of the monks said this, because they had a lot of activities. We don't have enough time to meditate. And he said, do you have enough time to breathe? So he was referring to the same idea, really, that the breath is there. We can use it like an anchor, reference point. And it can bring us back to the present moment. And so this is what I'm encouraging this evening. We can do the meditation, and then after that, I think there's a question, and we can also discuss the results. But so first of all, as I was mentioning, the intention, I'll go through this in guided meditation. Intention is important. Then bringing up a positive attitude this evening using gratitude. Gratitude, sometimes people are not very clear about gratitude. Gratitude is being thankful for something or someone. That's a very important. Appreciating is another way of looking at it. And also, very importantly, gratitude is not taking for granted. It's a very important quality to develop in the family, actually, or with people we're very familiar with. Because quite often when you live with people, you see the negative sides. You find fault. Familiarity breeds contempt, as they say in the saying. So it's very important to develop gratitude for the good qualities of these people, and to balance out things. So gratitude is very useful, thing to see. It's seeing what is there, the good things that are there, whereas often we see what's missing or bad points, faults. So very important. So first of all, any questions before we start the meditation? Yes, what's your question? What's that? Yeah, all right. Oh, I think that sounds like a good question.
It said intention, and you're going to do guidance on that, but intention then, am I just a little bit premature in asking the question, or where do you get your intention from?
Intention is just sort of what you're aiming at, actually, for the meditation. What is the goal in a way? But it's not sort of the goal in the sense that you're aiming at. If you arrive at that, good. If you don't arrive at that, okay. And you bring it up in the beginning, as Ajahn Brahm says, and then you let it be. But as I say, that example, becoming enlightened, well, Christians or other religious groups become enlightened. Well, if they don't have that intention, if they don't have that as their aim, then very unlikely that it will happen, because it's the same for us. So if we, for instance, don't have the intention when we meditate to be in the present moment, maybe we won't, actually. We maybe fall short of it. And often, people, when they're meditating, they're actually using it for a negative purpose. They want to get away from, say, stress, strain. They want to get peace, because they want peace because maybe a lot of stress going on. So these things, it's better to have a more positive aim, like just being in the present. They're more like expectations in a way. Yeah. I don't know if that was clear. I'm not sure about that one. So we can start the meditation. It's now 7:30. That's good. Right on time. So make yourself comfortable. Very important in meditation to be comfortable. And we can close the eyes and relax the body from the top of the head right through the whole body, especially the shoulders, around the eyes. There's any tight areas, areas with tension, just we can move them a little bit and relax them. We just can become aware of our intention in our mind. What are we aiming at for this meditation? Are we aiming at being present, being aware, being awake, being alert? What are we aiming at? So we're clear about why we're here. And now we can bring to mind that someone who has helped us a lot in the past or been a great benefit to us. This could be a family member, a friend. It could be a teacher from school or wherever. It could be a spiritual teacher, you know, one of the great teachers like the Buddha or Christ or Muhammad, whoever. And we can bring them to mind. Or we can bring to mind a situation that we're very thankful about. We're very pleased that it's happened. For instance, if you've been very sick and now you've regained your health, or something similar to that. Bring it to mind as vividly as possible, so a person or a situation. And we can just remember what they've done for us and how it's helped our lives. We can be aware of whatever feeling may have arisen because of that, because of being thankful. And in our minds we can thank that person, thank you very much. What a difference. Keep that feeling in mind, but we become aware of the breath coming in and going out. Wherever we're aware of it, it can be the tip of the nose, it can be the chest, the throat, the abdomen, wherever you're aware of it. And we infuse that feeling, we combine that feeling with that awareness of the breath coming in and going out, that feeling of gratitude. It's a very light awareness, a spacious awareness. We're not gripping the breath firmly. It's open. And it's the natural flow of the breath in and out. Nothing special. Not breathing deeply. Just natural, ordinary breath. And if the feeling subsides of gratitude, just remember that person or that situation, and you'll find the feeling comes back, and you can combine it with the breath. Grounding ourselves, we're centering ourselves using the breath in the present moment. just reflect for a few moments on how was that? How was that meditation? What does the mind feel like now? What was useful in the meditation? What worked well for you? Just before we end, we can share this energy from the meditation with all the beings here, all the people here, and with all our friends and family, wherever they are, and with all beings everywhere, that they may have gratitude, that they may have presence of mind that brings them happiness and peace. Slowly open our eyes and relax the body.
The question is, the lights come up slowly.
All right, thank you. Usually a good test for meditation is if you ask any question. Usually after meditation, if people have had a good meditation, there are no questions. It's a long way for a question. It's usually a dead waste of time then. But I just wanted to make a few points before I answer this question, whatever it is, that if we combine a positive feeling with whatever our meditation subject is. It doesn't have to be the breath. You know, you can use anything, really. You know, in the daily life, heaviness of the body, the contact of the body, you know, with the feet, with the ground, or the backside, with a chair, or whatever, the hands. Some people even use, you know, just every so often for present moment awareness, rubbing the fingers together. But the breath is a good one. It's always there, you know. But rubbing the fingers, too, is quite nice, actually. I quite like that one. You have to remember to rub them, whereas with the breath, you come back to it. Of course, you know, the breath is a very interesting thing in a way, because most people are utterly unaware of it. Whole lifetime of breathing. Only time they're aware of it generally is when there's a problem, you know. If we've got asthma, if we've got a bad flu, we can't breathe through the nose, whatever. But here we are, breathing all the time, and it's actually our lifeline. So the breath is a good one, very portable. and an easy one to come back to. But I thought you can use anything. Just remind us during the day, just to bring us back to the present moment. And what I think you'll find is not only will your mindfulness improve during the day, not only will you be more efficient, but you'll also have a better perspective on what you're doing in the moment. Because you just stand back a little bit, you know, and know what's happening at that moment. So it's a very useful reference point, I call it, or a grounding, centering device for our lives. And no surprise, when you come to sit down for meditation, you'll find the mind has much more, settles much more quickly than maybe previously. And combining it with that feeling actually makes the breath much more attractive, because the breath or whatever object you use, they're usually pretty neutral. There's nothing, inherently attractive about the breath. The breath just comes in and goes. Maybe it's sometimes warm, sometimes cold, things like that. So by adding a feeling to it, it really gives it a lot more power, and actually the mind will go for it. Actually, it will be more attracted to it. So that gives a lot of oomph to the meditation, actually. If you can do that, it doesn't have to be gratitude. You can use metta, you know, like we were chanting earlier. That's very good. If you can arouse metta, this feeling of wanting yourself and other beings to be happy, to be well, you know, or friendship, really, too. Being very friendly with them. Or, you know, you can have compassion, you know, this feeling of karuna, compassion, so that we're beings, somebody is, you know, having a difficult time, you have a feeling of empathy for them. You can use that. That's got a positive quality in it. And also, you know, mudita, this is the feeling of, sometimes they call it joy with others, but you know, when others have success, they're happy in their life, being happy for their happiness. And then, there's two people happy. Often people get envious rather than happy for other people's success, their happiness, and then there's one person very happy and oneself is very is probably unhappy. So you can maximize your happiness that way. And equanimity, sometimes we can't do a lot, but we still have a feeling of kindness and caring for people. You know, there are occasions, aren't there? Well, many occasions, actually. People can't hear you. You know, you want to help them. You want to do what you can for them, do the best for them, but they don't want it or they can't accept it at that time. But you can still have a feeling of support, of kindness. So that's very important, the combining the feeling with your meditation subject, using it through the day. And another important element is to not think of anything that occurs during the meditation as a problem or as a hindrance. It's not. It's something to be known. This is happening at the moment. This is what's going on. And you've still got that reference point there, the breath and the feeling with it, that's still there as the centre of your experience. But you're knowing what's going on. If we don't know what's going on, how are we going to develop wisdom? How are we going to understand? You know, when people first start meditating, the first thing they come across is they say, my God, there's so much thinking going on.
Yeah.
And they think, well, it's just since I started meditating. Before, there wasn't that much thinking, really. That's not true. We've been thinking all the time, but now we're aware of it. And it's like, if you don't know what the situation is, how can you improve it? How can you change it? You know, so first thing is to know. And when we know something, it's a completely different relationship to it from being it. You know, if you know an emotion, for instance, if you're depressed and you're being depressed, you're totally in a hole. You're totally down. But if you are knowing that, you've got a little bit of distance from it. You're looking at it from a different angle. You want to learn about it. You want to understand it. And this is a completely different relationship to our experience. So nothing is a problem, nothing is a hindrance, it's to be known. And by knowing it, we get to know ourselves better as well. You know, we know, oh wow, you know, I've got this, you know, I'm bored, or I've got depression in the mind, or whatever, you know it. Because in Buddhism, you know, in life actually, everything arises due to causes and effects. And for the Buddhist way of teaching, the Buddhist way of understanding is we must understand what we're experiencing. That's the only way things can change, only way things can end or, yes, finish. So, you know, often people, we have this strong feeling we want to get rid of something or we want something, and we think that's going to bring it about, but it doesn't. What brings that real change is understanding what's happening, what the situation is. And when we do fully understand, then things can change completely. We can let go of negative emotions and negative experiences. So very important, those two things, knowing, the difference between knowing and being, and also to keep a reference point during the day, throughout the day is good, very good. I call it a 24/7 practice. It's nothing too heavy, you know, it's a light awareness. We're not making hard work of it. If you make hard work of it, you know, you won't do it. So are there any questions about that meditation or comments, you know, that people found? I taught like this because this is what I use, actually. Everybody teaches what works for them, basically. But of course, you know, it's good to know that what works for one person doesn't work for every person. We all are slightly different. So it's it's useful to be exposed to different approaches. Good sign. I'm very pleased. That's good. Because when the meditation's good, you know, it's like that. There are no questions really, nothing to ask, you know, and that's good. That's good. It means that you know, the thinking's subsided for a time, so that's good. Yeah. That's good. So I'll just read out this question and we can answer that. Do you ever experience fear or anxiety, especially living in isolation? If so, how do you manage it? What have you learned from it? Oh, that's good. Good question. Yeah, good. So this is about fear and anxiety, you know, just generally, but especially living in isolation. And how do you manage it? And what have you learned from it? Yes. So it's a good question, and I think something that's applicable for all of us, isn't it? It comes up from time to time. I saw a very good poster somewhere recently which said that if we're experiencing anxiety, we're in the future, but if we're experiencing depression, we're in the past. And that's generally speaking true, actually. So anxiety is all about the future, you know, what might happen, and feeling, you know, like we can't. It may be overwhelming, we can't deal with it, we might not have the skills to deal with it, and so it's an emotion, very unpleasant emotion, actually, very unpleasant emotion, and most people want to get away from it as quickly as possible, and, you know, do their best, usually by distracting themselves, or doing some activity, you know, turning on the TV, having something to eat, or ringing a friend is probably the best in those situations. But of course, you know, from a Buddhist perspective, it's something to be understood, you know, having said what I've said. And that will make the real difference with anxiety and fear. And I've seen it for myself. I live, usually I live on my own in a forest in Sri Lanka. It's about a kilometre from the village. And most of the time I'm on my own. So you know, you're with yourself, with your emotions, with all the states in mind that, oh yes, there it is, come and go.
To be known and then ignored.
That's right, to be ignored, let go of. So, you know, when you live on your own, you know, your avenues of distraction are relatively few, you know, so you can read or listen to a talk maybe or something like that, but so you generally have to face these things and come up. And it's interesting, when you do face these things, if you have that sort of courage to face them, then you do get a new understanding of it. And I can remember one time, you know, waking up at 2 in the morning, I think it was, and, you know, having to go to the toilet at the age, men go to the toilet during the night usually, and which is very common, and then going back to bed, not being able to go to sleep, and then the mind can start to worry. You know, you can start to get anxiety coming up. It's really strange sometimes. It's sort of like freewheeling the life of its own. How ridiculous. But these things can come up. But I remember this one time it came up, and it was quite, for me, I mean, it may sound very ordinary, but the insight came, this is just unpleasant feeling. Underneath this anxiety, it's just unpleasant feeling. That's all it is. And that's what's underneath all of our unpleasant feelings, like fear, fear of death, all these things. It's just this unpleasant fear of this unpleasantness that we're feeling. It's nothing more. But what happens is, like with anxiety, with a lot of fears, we dress that unpleasant feeling up into a monster. You know, like, you know, when you're kids and you think the monster's living under the bed? You know, it's this unpleasant feeling, but we've put a monster onto it. It's nothing special. It's just unpleasant feeling. And when you have that relationship to it, it changes it quite a lot. Because you've seen what's really the foundation of anxiety, of fear. It's just this unpleasant feeling. The Buddha said there are three feelings that we basically that underlie all our experience. This unpleasant feeling, which we usually want to get away from as quickly as possible. And of course, the more you want to get away from it, the more it hangs around generally. So, and there's also pleasant feeling. Pleasant feeling is any of those sorts of feelings we have from pleasant sights, smells, tastes, touches, thinking. And there are many memories, nice memories and things like that. And we usually go between the two, don't we? Between pleasant and unpleasant. But in the middle, most of our experience is neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And you ask most people, you say, oh, you know, how do you feel? Oh, nothing, really. But what it is actually not pleasant, it's not unpleasant. And so actually we often call it a neutral feeling. And as your wisdom grows, as you understand the mind more, you can actually see that it's been quite pleasant, really. It's not unpleasant anyway. So my answer to that, or my own experience from that, dealing with fear and anxiety, is actually to see into it. But that has to be your own experience. You know, I can say to you, it's just unpleasant feeling. And that can sound sometimes like a Buddhist textbook, but when it's your own experience, it changes your relationship to it. Because no longer is it this sort of a daunting ghost, this monster, this huge thing. It's something that's just unpleasant feeling, that's it. You know, it's just no big deal. And actually it's quite good if you can see something like that, because it also changes your fear of death, which is often the really big one for all beings, actually, human beings, animals, everyone. So when you see it's just unpleasant feeling, and because of our delusion, we think it's incredibly overwhelming. And you know, pain can be very intense, can't it? But it's just basically unpleasant feeling. And when you can experience it like that, you're pulling the power out. And changing your relationship to fear and anxiety. So you can learn many things. And this is the important thing, you know, as I was saying before, is to learn from what we're experiencing. To know it clearly, and then to learn from it. Because that, as I say, that changes our relationship to it a great deal. Because we're no longer the sufferer, we're no longer the person who's anxious, no longer the person who's fearful. We're a person watching fear. We're a person watching anxiety. We're interested. We're curious. And you can use questions. You know, what's caused this? Where's this coming from? You know, not to get rid of it. That's the first thing, you know. As if you want to learn from anything, you don't want to get rid of it. You want to investigate it. Admittedly, as soon as you investigate, a lot of these things head off. That's because you change the relationship to it. Because if you're trying to get rid of it, you put a lot of energy into it, you're feeding it, and it continues. But if you investigate it, often it just disappears. So it's very important. But that's not just a tactic to get rid of it. because that doesn't help, you know, in the long run. What your understanding helps, actually. And then it can go by itself, and then you can be free of it. So that's a... I don't know what other people have any comments about that, or... But it's an important one. Fear and anxiety are an important one because, you know, these days there's a lot, you know, if you listen to the news or the radio or the internet, whatever, there's a lot, you know, that people can get fearful about.
When you say investigate it, do you mean, like, how would you start to investigate it? Do you have a formula that you follow, like 1, 2, 3?
Not really, but you can, you know, you can just ask questions that are relevant to it, you know, like whatever you're experiencing, what is this, you know, what is this feeling that I have, you know, where's it come from, what brought it up, you know, just these things. It's not so much the answer that's important, actually, it's just the questioning, looking into it. And the thing with this too is when we say question and investigate, it's just to put the question in there and just wait for the answer, if there is an answer, or maybe there's another question comes. And that does its work, actually, because we just want to see, you know, what's really going on. See it clearly, you know, and so the questions just perform that function, you know, they actually show us the nature of what we're experiencing from different angles, so it's good. So, you know, what's going on, you know, how's this come about, and that sort of thing, yeah. Yeah, it's very useful to use questions, actually, even during your meditation. If you notice, you know, you're getting dull or whatever, just ask your question, you know, what's going on, you know, and what's happening now. That's a very good question, what's happening now, that's good. Especially if you feel like you've lost the plot for the while, not sure where you are. Yes.
And you feel that feeling in your stomach, and you think, well, why do you think, you know, why am I feeling that? And,
yes.
You know, and, you know, what
yes.
can I do
yeah.
about it or whatever? And
yeah, they're good questions, actually, because that's it, you know, if you get to the source, then we've got a chance of understanding it, seeing where it's come. Actually, when we see where things come from, then actually... the mind lets go by itself. You don't have to do anything, you know. We've seen, we've understood, finished, you know. So, yeah, exactly, if we see the source, and there is actually a Pali word for that, you know, it's called yoniso manasikara. So it's a mind that goes back to the source. Actually, yoni is like womb, so it's going back to the source. And once you see things like that, then, you know, mind understands and lets go. Because yeah. letting go, you know, people often, you know, you hear this all the time, don't you? Let go, and people, I think they meditate and they sit there and say, let go, let go. Their face is all scrunched up. And, you know, that's not letting go. It's when the mind understands, actually, a particular situation, then it just lets go, you know, it knows, no point. Just, and then it drops. So it's really wisdom, Rebecca.
Investigate, and especially if you've created a fear after something that's not fearful.
Yeah.
What happens if you were in a dangerous situation?
Uh-huh.
Really fearful thing out there?
Yes. Yes, what happens when you're in a dangerous situation and the fear arises? In that situation, it's natural, isn't it? You know, and it is actually, you know, it's something that actually helps you in a sense, because you'll act immediately and there'll probably be adrenaline in the system. But nevertheless, you know, you usually have to act quite quickly, so that will be prompted by that fear. Nevertheless, you know, in any given situation, if we can have clarity as well, you know, like,
then you know how to react.
Then you know the best way. Because often, you know, if we're in a panic, sometimes the things we do just counterproductive, the wrong thing, you know. So if you can bring some clarity, just to be present, you know, it's pretty hard, you know, just to be present for that moment, and then what to do, just go for it.
Yeah, quite often when we think about things, we think, oh yes, I built that up, and I was, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, I don't know for you, but often in situations where there is, you know, it's a threatening situation, sometimes the reactions come quite naturally, and almost you might say from a deeper level of the mind, you know, sometimes people will say, I wouldn't have ever thought of doing that, or, you know, it just happened, I just did it, you know, and so it can be quite a natural response, so, yeah. But fear is not always an enemy in that sense, you know, because that alerts us, we've got to do something, you know, yeah, yeah. But it's, you know, fear and anxiety that's, you know, looking to the future, worrying about the future, creating a scenario, you know, that bothers us, then, you know, we can do something about that for sure. But if we have, you know, mindfulness and we're present in the moment, then we've got the best opportunity to, you know, see what's the best course of action. We do our best too, that's good. Yeah, yeah. So,
and you're fairly safe where you are in Sri Lanka?
Yes, yes, fairly safe actually. You know, I was staying in a monastery the last 9 months, got a lot of wild animals. But not really a big problem. I had bears coming to the kuti, to the hut, sorry. And but I'd hear him a mile off because he's a bit of an old bear too, like me. So I'd hear him, and he'd only come for a few minutes, you know, and then head off again. But we also had in that monastery elephant coming. Into the dining hall was very open, so it come in at night, and they had cupboards with food in it, metal cupboards, and you'd open them and take the food and then crush the cupboard. And this went on for about 2 or 3 weeks. There were 3 cupboards. He destroyed all of them actually. And you come in the morning, there'd be oil all over the floor, coconut oil and milk powder. He had a lovely time. So you know, there, even in that situation, don't really feel in danger, actually. No, I think if you're wise with animals too, you know, it's good. You avoid them as much as possible. One of the monks had very good suggestion. He said, you know, night time is the animal's time in the forest, so best not to be out at that time, you know, because the elephants are out, bears are out, leopards, and so on. Yeah, quite a few animals there. It's a nice place. It's, beautiful place. And many people are attracted, you know, to see wildlife. You go to a national park to see them, and here they are in a monastery, because the monastery is in a national park as well, actually, so it's quite good. Yeah.
And so, where is your own individual hut?
It's nearer the mountains in a town. The nearest large town is called Balangoda. And the hut is on the side of a mountain. It's a very beautiful place, actually. It's on the side of a mountain, so it's got forest all around it. Beautiful view. You can see the paddy fields below and mountains in the distance. And there's a stream that runs when it rains next to the hut. And it's a very, very beautiful place, actually. But Sri Lanka, there's many, many places like that. So
is it your choice to go and live like that? And why?
Why, yes. It is my choice. It's not compulsory, that's for sure. It's quite hard to find, actually. Because I think the reason is because the Buddha always encouraged it, actually. You know, once you have an idea of what to practice, how to practice, He advised or encouraged the monks and nuns to live on their own, because when you do that, you see your own mind much, much clearer. Usually when we've got interactions with people, you know, we can blame this person, that person, you know, they did this, they said that. But when you live on your own, you've got no one to blame. So you see things much, much clearer. And, you know, it's not always comfortable, of course, you know. And I think also, you know, there's conditioning too, because Western conditioning that's very common, I think, to get away from people is not an uncommon thing. You know, we want space, you know, and that's actually more coming from, we say in Buddhism, from defilement. For Sri Lankan monks, that's more uncommon. They don't, you know, to go into isolation is more difficult. It's not something that's a common desire, really. But there are some monks that are very, you know, Sri Lankan monks that do live in the forest, quite a few.
So does that aid your progress to enlightenment?
Yes, I think it does aid, you know. I personally feel, you know, periods in a monastery are good and periods living on your own. If you just live on your own, you can get stuck in your ways. And I have seen this, you know, some monks, you know, they get very much into having things the way they like, which is what you can do when you live on your own. But it doesn't lead to a lot of flexibility and, you know, you've got to be able to investigate your mind. And when you see your mind in different situations, living in a monastery and other situations, then it gives you an idea of, you know, what's really happening with your practice. So I would say some change. The Buddha always said, you know, all of us should use as a gauge, you know, if, you know, wholesome states, positive states of mind are growing, that place is a good place to stay. If unwholesome states of mind, negative states of mind are growing, it may be better to leave. Even if it's a comfortable place, you know, he said, even if it's good food, you know, comfortable huts, a good forest, whatever, he said, leave, you know. But even if a place is uncomfortable, not particularly good, you know, not particularly beautiful, not good food, but positive states of mind are growing, stay. So, you know, that's always the gauge for all of us, actually, to use that. But it's very useful to live on your own because it's not an easy thing these days. So.
What's the longest period you stay out in the forest?
Well, I've been living there more or less 4 years, but you know, as a rule, I have to go to Colombo as the main city sometimes during the year for visa, doctors, you know, dentist, and so on. So usually it'd be about a 3 month period. You know, I'd go maybe 3 times a year to Colombo and do things. So yeah, so it's that's very useful. Yeah.
How long have you been a monk? And how do you like sustain yourself out in your hut?
Oh, right. It's a good question, actually. I've been I was first ordained as a novice monk in 1997, so that was 18 years ago, and my anniversary of the 18th year was yesterday.
Oh,
the day before was my 17th anniversary of becoming a full monk, because it was both of them at the end of March, you know. So that's how long I've been a monk. And how I sustain myself is, you know, in being in a Buddhist country, they support Buddhist monks, Buddhist nuns, actually. And so I can go to the village every morning for food. And we have a big bowl, I don't know if you've seen it. And I usually go around 6 o'clock and go to about 4 houses, and they give rice and curries and fruit and sometimes, you know, sweet things as well. And, you know, a thermos of milk tea and so on. And then I come back to the hut and I can eat the breakfast then. And then later I keep the same food for the lunch. And that's for the morning. And that's it for the food side. And then I'm free after that to meditate and study, you know, do some chanting and that sort of thing. So that's how I sustain myself. And also, you know, they always ask, you know, if there's anything I need, you know, adupana, that's it, I think, well, anything that's missing, deficient, you know, and so that's, you know, like matches or candles or incense, whatever. And also when I go to Colombo, there are supporters there, they're very helpful too, so that's good. Because, you know, in a Buddhist country, they... it's seen as being good karma to support monks, especially meditating monks or nuns. You know, it's they like it a lot. So it's reasonably easy, actually. So good. Mm.
Yeah.
No, it is good. So thank you for that question, and I think it's about time we end up.